Tuesday, May 1st, it's my honor to reopen the Subcommittee on Education Innovation for the House. And we have two bills today, and we are really fortunate because one of the sponsors of the bill is one of our esteemed colleagues from the Senate, Senator Walker. And so with that, I'm going to open public hearing on Senate Bill 384A. Senator Walker.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a group of folks to come up with me.
Okay, and while you're being seated, I'll have committee staff say what this bill is all about.
Hey.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 384A prohibits school districts, education service districts, and public charter schools from entering into contracts with administrators providing compensation for work not performed, prohibits an administrator after the contract termination from purchasing district property or using district property differently than a member of the public, allows school districts, education service districts, and public charter schools to enter into contracts with administrators for health benefits beyond the employment period under certain circumstances. Defines administrator, applies to contracts on or after the effective date of the measure, declares emergency, and takes effect on passage. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Derek. Senator Walker.
Thank you. Welcome. Thank you for that welcome. I'm Vicki Walker, State Senator, District 7. And Derek read you the bill quite succinctly. We're all here holding hands, believe it or not.
I thought it was a kumbaya moment.
Let me tell you, last session I made them work for their money. Last session I had Senate Bill 766, and I tried every which way to get that bill passed. And I was always a step ahead of these guys, but they were always a step behind me. And actually, I was testifying on a bill at like 2:30 in the morning on sine die, hoping that I'd get my little amendment stuck in there. But since then, we've all had some incredible conversation about what was your issue, how can we resolve it, but how can we maintain the integrity of the system? Because I'll tell you what people really hate. They really hate finding out that somebody's walking away with a bunch of taxpayer money. And it's as luck would have it, this morning Senator Verger told me that the ESD superintendent, the South Coast, was given the boot. And it says right here, ESD board boot superintendent. And this is just printed hot off of my press. And Representative Roblin probably knows all about that. And you know what they talk about at the end, and I didn't print the comments.
Senator Walker, no talking in the classroom when somebody's presenting.
We're not talking about that.
Well, the comments that people were posting to the website were, oh, nice golden parachute. He walked away with what we're trying to prevent, and Mr. Bennett just got the heebie-jeebies when I walked in and told him about it. He walks away with a lump sum benefit. Now, I've seen worse, of $125,000. It's money he didn't earn. He just gets it because that's what they bargained for. And he also has his health and dental insurance until he's eligible for Medicare. Now, we do allow for that in the bill because that's common practice, and that was one of our areas that we agreed to. It is common practice in private industry as well. But he wouldn't have walked away with $125,000. We had many, many instances of folks walking away with packages that were just unheard of. And you notice the provision in the bill about no property. They can't use property of the district. That's because someone got a really special deal on an automobile right here in this community with Willamette ESD. And they walked away with a vehicle that was worth about $26,000, and they paid about $7,000. So, you know, those are the things that make people really angry, and that's what Tricia Smith will talk to you about, why her members get so frustrated by it. For me personally, it's simply the taxpayers don't want to vote on these school budgets anymore because they think, you know, we're just ripping everybody off and we're throwing the money away. So I just want accountability. That's what we're all about here, all of you. I know I wear that big scarlet letter A under my shirt every day. And so we've got a kumbaya here, and we're really pleased that you're hearing our bill. Thank you.
My only comment, Senator, before you take and have to leave to your next committee, I thought underneath your suit was the superwoman. So.
Well, that's what my husband calls me, because I never stop, but thank you.
Tricia Smith.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Tricia Smith. I represent Oregon School Employees Association. In the last session, OSEA requested Senate Bill 766, and Senator Walker was just a champion in helping us try to move that bill through the session. My members asked that this bill be introduced and hopefully passed because they work very hard at the local level to try to get school bonds passed, operation levies passed, the right folks elected that will support schools, those kinds of things. And all of that work, they believe, is for naught when one headline comes up at the top of the fold of an administrator walking away from a district with a huge, unearned severance package. We saw letters to the editor in a variety of communities after this had happened from people who said, I'll never vote for another school levy as long as they're going to give money away, et cetera, et cetera. And we felt that this was a public policy issue that needed to be addressed in this building because we felt that school districts didn't have the ability, honestly, to negotiate contracts that they could then live with when the administrator left. And it needed some parameters around those contracts. Unfortunately, in Oregon, we have a situation where school districts feel that they must compete nationally for superintendents, and in those situations they sometimes enter into contracts that they then regret at the other end. And we believe that this bill, which is our improvement of 766, is a very important bill that we hope you will pass this session because it will give us that accountability that we all want, that credibility that we all need in our communities, and we hope we can prevent the kinds of abuses that have occurred in the past so that our constituent bases will begin to see that we are doing everything we can to spend every dollar wisely in our schools. So with that, I will allow my friend Mr. Bennett to tell you how sweet and good this bill is, which which really feels so good to me.
Madam Chair, my name is Chuck Bennett. I represent the Confederation of Oregon School Administrators. Yeah, we're very pleased with the outcome of our work with Senator Walker. She deserves a great deal of credit for keeping us all focused on, I think, what the outcome of this bill, along with Ms. Smith and her union. They have really kept us, I think, focused on what the message of these headlines has been in communities. I would only say that we're talking about thousands of school administrators in Oregon and a handful of headlines. That's all it takes. And unfortunately, that is the case. And I have talked with several of you individually about this. I've had different opinions of this at different times, but I think you just have to at some point look at this and be persuaded that perception is reality. And in the cases of administrators walking away with what are in anyone's vocabulary, large settlements, and there are a couple of them that are particularly difficult to explain. You have to take a look at a statute like this to assist school districts and administrators to understand what the sideboards look like on these contracts. And I think with the good offices of Senator Walker, we were able to work our way through this. We were able to address the kinds of issues we were seeing out there, and I think to do so very directly, very specifically, there shouldn't be much left to the imagination with passage of this bill. And I think the example that Senator Walker gives is just one more example of why this bill needs to be passed past this session, and hopefully we'll see an end to this discussion. And if we don't, we'll be back here with you. I'm sure Senator Walker will bring us all back together to talk about it further. But I think that this offers a real reasonable and a targeted solution to this problem. So I hope you'll pass it. We're very pleased with the opportunity to have worked on this.
Mr. Green.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Jim Green with the Oregon School Boards Association. I'd like to go on record as well as thanking Senator Walker for her work on this. Senate Bill 776 from last session was something we couldn't support. And I think the version of 384 that you saw originally in your bill packets that's not the engrossed was another version we had problems with. And Senator Walker probably could have passed that bill through this legislature with a lot of opposition from us, but she was willing to sit down and work with us, and I want to take this opportunity to thank her for that. A great deal of work went in from all four of us sitting at the table here, and Senator Walker spearheaded that, and I wanted to thank her for her work on this. Getting to the bill specifically, and if you have questions about it, one of the things that we were questioned on, and I've gotten calls from a lot of Mr. Bennett's members and my members, what exactly does this do? What it says for every administrator, and if you take a look at line 9 of the bill, it says administrator doesn't include a person who's subject to the various ORSs in Chapter 342. Those are the Fair Dismissal Appeals Board statutes. So if you are subject to those, and those are principals and vice principals in our state, they are subject to Fair Dismissal Appeals Board statutes. So they would not be covered by this because they already have a contract with school districts. But this does cover superintendents, assistant superintendents, transportation directors, food service directors, business managers, a whole litany of folks who didn't have a specific written contracts before, and now they're going to be covered by this because of instances I think you've all read about in the newspaper, and we were willing to do that. I think the key and operative part of the bill that really does what we're talking about here is found in Section 1, Subsection 3, which is lines 16 through 19 of the bill. And if you take a look at lines 18 and 19, it says, you can't enter into an employment contract with an administrator that contains provisions that expressly obligate the district or the school to compensate the administrator for work that is not performed. That stops the idea of what we call a golden parachute. One of the questions I asked Senator Walker when we were sitting down was, now, Senator Walker, does this mean that if we have a superintendent, remember superintendent contracts in our state are limited to 3 years
right.
in statute. So let's say you have a superintendent who got hired. He or she is in the first year of their contract with a school board. And a school board gets elected, and their mantra is, we want to get rid of this superintendent. That's what they're running to get elected for, and we have that going on right now in this state. And that cadre of candidate gets elected. Does that mean that that superintendent's fired and they can't be paid for the remainder of their contract? And hopefully Senator Walker will nod yes when I say this means that you can pay those folks for the remainder of their contract. The contract is still the contract. But what you can't do is say, we'll pay that person an additional $125,000, $150,000. It stops the golden parachute, but it doesn't stop the provision of saying, you've got a negotiated contract, and we will pay you for the end of your contract. You can't do that, number one. It would violate the contracts clause of both the U.S. and Oregon Constitution. But what it does stop are those huge payouts that we've seen in the paper, and that we want to stop. Because I think, as Mr. Bennett said, perception does become reality. And you hear the kind of comments that Ms. Smith testified to. I won't vote for another school budget for as long as I have to. Another bond comes before me, I'm not going to vote for it. They're just wasting our money. And it gets in the paper, and people start to believe it. And that's what this bill is designed to eliminate, is that perception. We do go on further on in the bill to say to folks, and I think Senator Walker alluded to this, that we will provide health insurance benefits for folks until they either find another job, but that's part of the contract. Until they find another job with health insurance benefits or until they're Medicare eligible. And I think that's important because you do not want to put those folks out on what we call the proverbial ice floe with one of the largest costs that they're going to be faced with, which is health insurance. We do support the bill. We thank Senator Walker and Ms. Smith for their work on the bill. And I think any one of the four of us would be happy to answer any questions.
Representative Roblin and Representative Dahlem.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This, and I'll speak directly to the one you have. This enactment takes effect on passage in the governor's signature. In the particular one that's mentioned, they really don't leave until after June, into July. Even though they've made a contract now, I don't think we can change that. Is that correct?
Madam Chair and Representative Roble, you're actually right. This is already a contract in existence, and this law, even though we've got an E-clause on it, We can't get to that because it's already a contract. But you know what? They're looking for a superintendent, and they say they're going to try to get one in 3 to 4 months. So if we can get this bill passed and get it on the governor's desk, they won't be making this mistake again, because your South Coast district has testified in front of my committee and how starved they are for funds, and they're frustrated by the new graduation requirements because it only gives $10 million to the whole state to help people get new teachers for the science and math requirements and all that. And South Coast specifically said in my committee, that's only under the state's funding formula, that's half a teacher.
Right.
Half a teacher is what we're going to get. Well, $125,000 that they just gave away, you know, that's more than half a teacher.
And just to follow up, I mean, mostly just a statement. I mean, the reality is, in this committee last week, we heard from some South Coast people how hard it is. And I got a number of emails because of this that basically said, I thought you said there was a funding crisis in schools on the South Coast. What do you mean there's a funding crisis? And then I got, you know, this attachment and mail. So I just want to make sure that people clearly understand. I appreciate all these people came to the table, because these things kill us. And not only kill us, they also cost a teacher or two, because the money won't be there, and we already are cutting. And so it is difficult for me. And so I appreciate you bringing the bill.
You're welcome. I was determined to bring it back.
Representative Dahlman and Representative Wisnett.
Yes, Chuck, what's the average superintendent salary right now in the state?
Madam Chair, Representative Dahlman, if I could take that question. I think the last time we looked, and we do salary surveys of classified, and what you're talking about are superintendents, which are confidential folks. I don't remember what the exact average was, but we had the lowest somewhere in the 50s to the highest was somewhere over $100,000, well over, if I remember exactly. But I think the average falls somewhere around 60 to 70, because we have more smaller districts in this state than we have larger districts. And I think it's somewhere in the 70s, 60, 70, 80, last time I looked, somewhere in there, Representative. But we have way more smaller districts than we do those larger districts that pay that higher salary.
Where I'm going with this is, and I want to be sure that we get done what you want to get done, but I know of a superintendent in a small school that's $125,000, and it is not a big school, and his salary is not. In fact, I would like, if you could give us a salary schedule book, could we see one of those?
Yeah.
That'd be great.
But anyway, let's look at the numbers for a moment, because if we fall under Mr. Green's scenario, and we have a midterm contract, and the backside is 2 years, we're going to pay our guy $250,000 on the balance of his contract.
Plus that, okay.
And there's no way to keep that out of the news. And that is the golden parachute, I think, sickens everybody in the room. But if we were to have a guy on a 3-year contract dismissed in the 6th or 7th or 8th month, we'll have a third of $1 million paid out. And so I'm wondering how many of the payouts were golden parachutes and how many were payouts to superintendents for balance of contract?
I think, Madam Chair, Representative Dahlem, I think you're pointing to one of the difficulties in defining the issue. I really can't tell you, because they are not presented publicly that way. I mean, you know, in terms of the news story. So you get, I think whenever you have a payout, you have a golden parachute in terms of the public perception and definition. It's reasonably rare that we're seeing superintendents come in for very short periods of time and asked to leave. More commonly, and I think a good example is probably down in Ashland, as I recall, there was a change. Correct me if I'm wrong, Representative, but as I recall, there was a change in the school board, and really what happened was they took a look at what it would cost to buy out the contract to ask to have the superintendent leave essentially without cause, and determined to keep her in place, that it was a better, both fiscal and probably, well, not even probably, a better educational decision to keep the superintendent in place. I think that's the more common, and it is the way superintendents tend to be protected in terms of some sort of arbitrary dismissal. Yeah, I think that. But I can certainly provide you with, I think, the kind of information you're looking for.
Thank you, Chuck. What I'm trying to do is arm you with some information so that if we pay a balance of contract, Senator Walker won't haul you in and say, what's going on? And remember Dahlem's comment.
Thank you. I think, though, the way it'll play in the press, Representative.
We know how it'll play.
Yeah.
And Madam Chair, Representative Dahlem, if I might, when we see these contracts, and there's instances when OSBA and COSA are not aligned on issues, and superintendent contracts, that's one of those areas where we represent the board, they represent their member, and we have a difference of opinion on what ought to be in those contracts. But when I look at those contracts, there's always a dismissal for cause, and you've seen those as a superintendent. You've had those in your contract where you get dismissed for cause. There's a different issue with regard to the contract as opposed to dismissal without cause. And I think that's where you see some of those issues that you're bringing up. And as those come out, and they will come out, we will have to justify that, hey, this was a board who got elected not because they were getting rid of a superintendent for cause. They just wanted to get rid of a superintendent. And they need to take a look at that in some instances as a business decision. And I think Mr. Bennett just laid one out down in the Ashland area where they looked at it and they said, it's going to cost us more to do this than it is to keep this person around for a while and let the contract expire. And those are decisions that are made based on community needs, the board needs, maybe the evaluation of the superintendent. I know three of you sitting here, administrators on the committee, and you've probably looked at your contracts and said there's dismissal for cause and dismissal without cause, and there's different ramifications and different payouts for each one of those. But I think one of the things that Senator Walker really worked on this time was to say, we're not going to violate someone's contract if they've negotiated it, but what we're not going to have is paying folks for not working that's not in their contract. So it stops that super stipend is what I would call it, that the press just loves to eat up and really hurts us publicly with the newspapers.
And Madam Chair, Representative Dahlem, let me just say that we did discuss this for cause issue. We got stuck on that for a little while. And actually, some of our language comes from Portland because Portland Public Schools had their own problems. We won't go over them again here, but we did discuss that. And what I want to do was leave districts some flexibility. At some point, school boards have to take the responsibility for what they're doing. And if they pay someone an exorbitant amount of money, then someone's going to be held responsible for that if folks don't like that. But this golden parachute stuff was just too loosey-goosey, and it was happening, and we didn't really know. And so I just felt like this, they don't need flexibility on golden parachutes. They just need to be told not to do them. And then the rest of the salary stuff, they can just negotiate that within their own districts.
I think we're in the same place, but I do want one follow-up, if I might. And I'm sure that has to do with, I know that several of our school districts have been very successful in competing for national searches. This won't inhibit that in any way, will it?
Mr. Chairman, or Madam Chairman, I'm sorry, and Representative Dahlem, I don't believe it will. If they want to come to Oregon and they don't want to have a contract that pays treble damages upon being fired, and that's the one. I mean, let's be real clear, the problems we ran into, I think, in terms of the one that troubled me the most was in Portland, where an administrator had a termination of their contract, and in the contract were multiple-year payment as damages for being let go. If that stops someone from coming to Oregon to be a superintendent, so be it. That is not what we want to have happening, and I know you don't either. I know that, and I appreciate your description of what the reality is most commonly, which is a superintendent is having their contract paid out as they're being asked to leave. I mean, I think that needs to be clear. That does not change, and it's that kind of protection. If that were gone, I think we really would be looking at problems. If we could not offer contracts that are enforceable just for the, particularly when you're looking out of state or even in state, in a state this large where people make major life changes in order to move from one district to another, you really have to have some certainty built into it, and that's what those contracts are. But to go beyond those contracts into damage awards, Or you get a car when you walk away, or you get a, you know, those kinds of things are just not going to be acceptable. I can't believe that's going to chase anyone off.
Thank you
not.
For your
response. Yeah. Thank you very much, Madam Chair.
Representative Wisnett.
Thank you, Madam Chair. First, Senator Walker, thank you for your work in bringing this bill. I apologize I couldn't come to your committee this morning. I'm just glad you passed my bill.
You were a little bit trapped. And we did pass it and had a little fun with it. Thank you.
Ma'am, I understand. For Mr. Green and Mr. Bennett, I think, if I remember correctly, the Oregon Report Card 2005 lists the average superintendent pay as $94,000. I think in my district I represent, we have a couple that make a little more than that. But I need your help on the letter that email that Mr. Witte sent, and both of you were infoed on it, asking you to be sure that the contract that he uses representing the school boards in Lapine, Ben Lapine, Redmond Sisters, Crook County, and Culver, that clause he has about, as you discussed earlier, termination without specific cause is not a problem. Did you get a chance to...
Madam Chair, Representative Wisnett, I think you're talking about John Witte. He's an attorney with the High Desert ESD over there. Mr. Bennett and I have had lengthy conversations with Mr. Witte about that, and we believe, as does Jim Brown, who's the attorney for COSA, and we've had several lawyers on our staff, and I also happen to be one of those evil JD-impaired people as well, looked at this, and I don't think it will impair their ability of those contracts that they write in the High Desert ESD. And just for clarification, when Representative Dahlem asked, he was looking at statewide. You said in your region it was $94,000. Is that correct?
It was $2,000. That was the report card.
That's the statewide?
Yeah.
And I don't know what information that has, but I will get you the salary survey that we have, and I think it's less than that, but I'll clarify that, Representative Wisnett. But I don't believe, and Mr. Bennett can answer as well, we looked at that language, and I don't think it's going to interfere with his ability to write contracts on behalf of the board as it relates to cause.
Thank you. Without cause.
Without cause.
Yeah.
With or without cause, either way.
He was concerned about, Madam Chair, can I follow up?
Representative Wisnett, follow up.
He was specifically talking about termination without specific cause.
And Madam Chair, Representative Wisnett, we did not deal with that in here. If someone is going to be terminated without cause, their contract should explain what happens in that instance. They're not prohibited from doing that under Senate Bill 384.
Thank you.
Short comment on that question.
Just a clarification. When they get the averages, make sure that we know if it's the mean, median, or mode. Because
okay.
We could be talking about averages,
right.
All of us. And
Madam Chair, Representative Brown, I went to law school to avoid math. You have to understand.
Well, I would like to just say, Madam Chair, and Representative Roblin, and all of you on the committee, I did a remonstrance on the floor of the Senate yesterday, holding up the Coos Bay World that outlined all the salaries of all the elected officials, and you were on there, and so was Senator Berger. We all make that measly pay of a little around $18,000. It's $18,405 or something like that, and that includes your per diem. So I just want to put that in perspective with the $94,000 that
right.
You're up here toiling away with a $12 billion budget, and you are making $18,000. So,
and
I'm going to recognize that. Thank you, Representative Buckley.
One of our witnesses.
I'm sorry.
There's just been too much talk about just cause for me not to chime in here and say that Senate Bill 766 and our position coming into negotiation on this bill was that termination with cause was one of those situations where we did not believe an administrator should be paid out through the end of their contract. If they are not doing the job, they should be treated the same way my members are, and that is they get their tails fired. And they don't get paid off when they leave. However, in the wonderful art of negotiation, we have moved beyond that piece for the moment. But I will tell you, though, that we still believe that cause is very important. We offered to put just cause in the statute for all school employees, but OSBA didn't think that was a great idea. So we will
work with very
we will continue to look at this issue, because it is true that when a superintendent or anyone else who is a public sector worker who is fired with cause, and then the public finds out that they have to get a big payout because they have a contract that says so, then they think that maybe was a mistake. And so in the future, we may be back with some issues around that, and I'm sure OSBA will then love just cause in the statute.
Representative Buckley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just to kind of clarify the record, the situation in Ashland was a school board coming in. Many of the candidates very angry with the superintendent. The superintendent had to preside over the closing of two of our elementary schools, two of our five. Very, very, very tough stretch time for the district. It was at the end of the superintendent's contract, was the first year with the new board, and the new board ended up negotiating a new contract with the superintendent, particularly after the new board got into their positions and reviewed the budget and reviewed the options and really dug in deep to find out what the situation in the district was. And not only did they re-sign the superintendent to a contract, but the district's running very well at this point.
I just hope the school board members weren't called flip-flops.
They were, but
Representative Gollum.
I'm sure they were. Having been on the school board, I want to go back to Senator Walker's point, and I think her remonstrance was well in order. In my district, I have several superintendents that are paid far more than our district judges. I'm not sure whether the superintendents are overpaid or our judges are way underpaid. But if I miss an opportunity to say that, I'm going to kick myself tonight.
Committee, any more questions for this panel? Because we have one other person wants to speak. I would like to make one comment before you leave, and that's to Mr. Green. My first elected position was a school board member in 1986, and that experience grounded me in policy. And it is my love of policy, and you guys do an excellent job in helping newbies understand their role and the policies all schools should follow. So thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Madam Chair. And I just want to
thank you, Senator.
These folks, they worked really hard. And when we went into the work group, I told them I probably had the votes to pass the bill as it is, but that I really, really thought that we should sit down, and they did that. And that's what I like about policy.
That's right.
That's what I like
about
policy.
That's a good part of it. Thank you. With that, Mr. Cluding, you want to come forth and share your wisdom?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Committee, it's too bad people have to step forward on issues like this. Bill Flitting, Carpenters Industrial Council. Sitting back there, I think now we're starting to see what's wrong with Oregon's education. There's no logical reason why things like this should happen. If you've heard that term, there ought to be a law. Well, for sure. This bill needs to become a law. Sitting back there listening, it seems like we have a problem with our contracts. I think the state needs to take a long look at how these contracts are wrote. Our tax dollars is supposed to go to educating our kids and to make sure our teachers don't have 30 or 35 kids in a classroom. We're running teachers away from this state. We're running our kids away from our public schools. Three sessions now, I've tried to work bills through to increase the timber cuts in the Tillamook Forest, the Elliott Forest, to benefit our schools. And what happens? You start reading the newspapers. Another thing that has to be changed, Madam Chair, committee, is this little episode that happened in Salem here a couple of years ago. I called two of the board members in the evening. I says, you're going to get a phone call pretty soon to have a board meeting tomorrow. Oh, how do you know? What's it about? And I says, well, it's... seems like your superintendent's going to drive away in a new car, 5 years insurance. Well, how do you know all this stuff? I said, well, I got an inside source, but this is what's going to happen. The board members never even knew This was a closed hearing between the superintendent and his best friend, who happened to be the chairman of the board. And that's wrong. That should have been a public meeting, full board, 24-hour notice, and put in the newspapers. This is why you can't get school bonds passed, school levies passed. This is why Oregon's struggling with our education for our school kids. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Clute. Is there anyone that has any questions for this witness?
Thank you.
Thank you.
Amen.
Any other witnesses or discussion in the public hearing?
Madam Chair, are we going to be moving to a work session?
I'm thinking we might just as well move to a work session unless I hear any or see any opposition to that. Okay. I will close the public hearing on House Bill 38. Senate Bill, boy, that's going to be a hard habit to break. Senate Bill 384, the A engrossed version, and I'm going to open a work session on Senate Bill 384A. Representative Roblin.
Chairman Kopp, I move Senate Bill 384-A to the Education Committee with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you, Representative Roblin. Any discussion? There's been a motion to move Senate Bill 384-A to the full committee. Would the clerk please call the roll?
Representative
Buckley?
Aye.
Representative
McCannon?
Aye. Representative
Dahlin?
Aye.
Representative Minnis?
Excused.
Representative Roblin?
Aye.
Representative Whitman?
Aye.
Chair
Kopp? Aye. The motion carries, and this will be taken to the full committee. I would love to take it to the full committee, and also if we, I'm sure Senator Walker would be back if we want to hear her thoughts for the full committee, so if you'll keep track of us, Derek?
Sure.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, committee. Thank you, presenters. With that, I'm going to open a public hearing on SJM 12. Staff, please. Okay.
Senate Joint Memorial 12 urges Congress to amend the No Child Left Behind Act of 2001 to provide for waiver and adequate federal funding. And there's no subsequent referral. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Wilson. Looks like Representative Kopp is going to be in front of us to explain our thoughts on the joint memorial.
Thank you, Chair Buckley and committee. It's my pleasure to bring SJM 12 to the committee. Where to begin with No Child Left Behind? It is Congress's best wishes for every student in our nation to be successful. A little bit of history on the No Child Left Behind Act. There has been federal funds that have been given to states in order to educate all of our public children. And those original enactments started over 30 years ago. 30 plus years, no one in Congress said, what do the states do with this money? So several years ago, they said, I think it's time we check and see how the states are spending our money. That was one of the first steps that began No Child Left Behind. I personally applauded their thought, well, I'd want to know where my money goes also. But the result is not something that I've come to support or love. And the result is 64 different measures that every school must be successful at meeting that receives any federal funds, which is my understanding somewhere between 75 and 85% of the school districts in the state, in order to meet adequate yearly progress. And I want to say again, 64 different components in order to meet adequate yearly progress. That means if you have a student that's in poverty, a student that is Hispanic, and that same student is a special ed student, has a minimum of 5 to 10 conflicting things. If they don't pass every one of those tests, that student will not meet adequate yearly progress. And so the challenges for districts, much like the district for one in which I have served as a teacher and administrator, is very intensive. The good things about No Child Left Behind, it has made us very data-driven about our student success or failures. We've had a number of students to be successful, but the purpose of this bill is to make sure that we continue with the, what I think is a minimum amount of federal funds in order to support our schools. We know our world state, and with our nation's perspective on supporting the war, and I'm not going to say one way or the other on that, but that does come at a cost, and right now that cost very may well come out of funding for school districts. In the past few years, there has been, since the No Child Left Behind Congressional Act, there has been minimal increments of the federal funding. And now it is plateaued, and we're told, without a doubt, because we're going into such a federal deficit, that federal funds will be cut. So therefore, this act, this House, the Senate Joint Memorial, is to have Congress look at this once more and redefine the federal role into K-12 education and see if we can't adequately fund the program. And that is the full point of this, and I was honored to work with Senator Avakian, and we became very good friends last session over a number of bills that we passionately disagreed on. And so we'd sit down and, again, talk about policy. And when we talked about this one, the one about federal funding, it was definite consensus. So any questions that you might have, I'm here to hopefully give you a good response.
Questions, ma'am? Representative Dahlin.
Yes, I'm reading lines 8 through 13 of that page. There is no separation. The waiver is if the bill or if the act is not fully funded. We're not asking for a waiver. For example, if it was fully funded, we wouldn't ask for a waiver?
I don't believe so, Representative Dahlin. Thank you, Chair Buckley. Senate Joint Memorial is to continue receiving at least as much funding as we've been receiving.
Mr. Chair, do we have others that are going to testify?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, there are 1, 2, 3, 4 other people who've signed up to testify. Department of Education is here to answer any technical questions, but is not planning to testify. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I think my questions are more technical. Thank you.
Good. Thank you, because don't get too deep on me, Representative.
Any additional questions, Representative Kahn? I just had one question in terms of the letter that was sent to us by the Superintendent of Public Instruction, or by Ed Dennis, actually Deputy Superintendent. Have you a chance to read that over?
I have not had an opportunity, Chair Buckley.
It does. It brings up some specific concerns with the language in the memorial, and I think it's worthy of discussion. But since you haven't had a chance to look it over, then
the only information I have is with a conversation with Senator Ivakian yesterday, he has met with Superintendent Castillo, and she has very politely shared those concerns, and that she has been working extremely hard in the previous years to have the federal government looking at a growth model for how to assess student achievement versus a test.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that she has been very purposeful in those actions, and yet, as far as funding goes, again, we just had an incredible presentation in the last few minutes about perception. I believe there is a perception that, well, and we do, we need to make sure our education is funded to its fullest, and that is Senator Ivakian's and my belief and purpose here. It is not to, in any way, and I please want to put this on the record, to undermine or cause a barrier what the superintendent has been doing, and only would say if she wants us to work with her sometime back in Washington, D.C., let us know. Because we're very passionate about making sure our students have what they deserve.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Whistler.
Thank you, Mr.
Chairman. Did you have a question?
Yes, ma'am.
Thank you.
I think this letter from the superintendent's office is has some points that I would be concerned about too, Representative. One of the questions I guess I would ask you is when you crafted the memorial with Senator Ivakian, because it seems like a big difference between asking for flexibility and waiver. Did you discuss that? Was that part of your discussion and when you drafted the bill?
That was not, I did not have, I'll be very upfront, I did not have an in-depth discussion on that, and if the committee sees fit that we need to do a little more research, or particularly listen to the representatives from the department today, I think it's very appropriate.
Just to follow up, Mr. Chair and Representative Compey, I think that there's some really good points in the superintendent's letter that I would feel more comfortable with. So
thank you. Thank you, Representative.
Representative Dahlin.
I would like to thank Representative Compey. We had this bill in our hand. We got it back. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Dahlin.
Thank you, Representative. Thank you, Representative Compton.
If you want to go ahead and continue, Chair.
Mr. Olson, if you would.
We have four people signed up. My suggestion, Mr. Chair, we call them up in twos to testify.
That's
right?
Good.
Chris Allman and Dan Charles Lindstrom, I believe.
Welcome. Thanks for being here. And you can go in whichever order you prefer.
I'll go ahead and start. Madam Chair, thank you, the committee, too. My name is Chris Allman, and I'm a parent of the Beaverton School District, which is where Senator Ivakian is representing that district. And I have known him for quite a few years now. His children went to the same school that my daughter went to. And I've been an activist in public education for quite a while. I hold here the What to Know and Where to Go Parents Guide to No Child Left Behind, A New Era in Education, which is what I picked up in early 2002 when, at that time, I was a site council member in my second year for Montclair Elementary.
Could you sit back? The microphones are very, very sensitive, so if you just get comfortable. And
okay.
Yeah, thank you.
And immediately I came to realize that this No Child Left Behind Act had many, many flaws, one of which is requiring that by 2014 all children will be succeeding. And I can tell you that as a physician, I'm a physician, I have not practiced for about 9 years, it seemed implausible to me that this could ever be considered. But I do want to step back a little bit at this point and let you know that one of the reasons why I'm not practicing is because at the time in 1998, My son was young. He was about 3 years old, and he had been found to have a language delay. And from there, I realized it was too hard for me to balance everything I need to do, and so I became involved in advocacy for him. But along the way, I also did things in the community, which started out with being a court-appointed special advocate. And I learned a lot about what it is that people who come from poor means and circumstances that might have their basis in a poor education, how important it is for us to have good education. And so that has set the stage for me to do a variety of things, including having been involved with Representative Cannon on a committee on early childhood and education with Portland City Club. In any case, I also want to point out that Representative Comp and Senator Avakian come from two very disparate areas, with Woodburn being a very high poverty area and Beaverton more affluent. Mm-hmm. So I think that you're seeing people who have representing widely based interests. In any case, I'd like to first show what I thought is a good symbol of what I believe No Child Left Behind is all about. I was just thinking of No Child Left Behind as being a public spanking, basically. And so I found this table, which looks at corporal punishment in America's public schools. And what I think you might agree with me is that this appears to be very centric in the southern states. In fact, the states with the highest rates of corporal punishment are Mississippi, Arkansas, Alabama, Tennessee, Oklahoma, and Louisiana. I believe that No Child Left Behind's public spanking of schools is disproportionately affecting the poor schools as well. The unintended consequences, I think, have been anticipated, and while No Child Left Behind is a sacred cow, I think we need to do the kind of things that are being proposed with this memorial. I know that to provide every boy and girl in America with high-quality education, regardless of his or her income, ability, or background, has a lot of merit. I agree with that. But I do believe what's happening here is, with the sacred cow, we've got so many special interests at the teat of the cow, and it's our children, it's the young calves that are not winning in this situation. So it is the grossly inadequate funding that's part of it, but I also believe that we have inattention to strengthening our families. We have a widening income gap with tax breaks to the rich individuals and corporations, and we have, most importantly, these punitive high-stakes testing, which I'm going to elaborate a little bit more about. I believe that in the past 15 years, we've had property taxes, changes with our property taxes, measures 5, 47, 50, and with measure 11, that we've decreased tremendously what our schools are getting. And this gives us an unquantifiable privatization through our individual school districts and school fundraising. And I also believe that we in the Pacific Northwest can take full credit for a large part of what's happened with No Child Left Behind, because a man named Mark Tucker, who came from Northwest Regional Labs, was involved with Schools for the 21st Century. And this legislation started in the state of Washington. They had pilot studies. They put a lot of money into it, and it didn't work. And yet it became embraced and was led to us getting No Child Left Behind, being the template for it. In any case, I think that these high-stakes testing create more vice. And I think they do that with this data-driven decision-making that is has a dissonance, because there's problems with transparency. I believe that standards-based reform has problems with accountability. We have curriculum wars and common curriculum problems, and there's funding disparities and equity issues. I just want to show you this sheet with the William Walker data. This is from the Beaverton School District, and I think that if you look at the upper right-hand corner and you look at these really great numbers in this Title I school, you think, wow, No Child Left Behind is really working. But then If you go in the lower left corner, you see the student performance, and you see much lower scores. And you wonder, okay, so what data is driving our decision-making? And these this disparate information comes out often. I have found state writing scores, for example, 20 to 30% differences in what I see on the State Department of Ed website and what I've seen printed locally in the newspapers. These kind of things lend to distrust. In our school district, we've had some issues with mathematics. This is all these curriculum wars with the National Council of Teachers of Mathematics, mm-hmm. changing performance standards. These are taking the standards ball is making it very difficult for our school districts in general. And with regards to mathematics, we had a conflict of interest problem that too has created distrust. And I see at the national level, University of Oregon has been getting a lot of heat because of the Reading First grants. Again, this is indicative of individuals who recognize the potential for earning lots of money in these circumstances. As a physician, I believe that it's really important that we have good medicines, therapies, and procedures, and that we have to prioritize cost-saving generic and preventive care. I think it's true for our educators, too. But I think that if we were to say teacher do no harm and restrict their choices, that it just won't work. And then when we don't have the funding for this, again, we are not serving our children. So without strong federal conflict of interest policies governing educational research among our partner agencies, I think that this graft will just explode. I think that we have problems with our high school diploma and dropout rates. There's a lot of confusion as to what these numbers mean. We do have a dropout rate of 4.1%, which is a record low here, but included in that are those kids who are working on their GED and other numbers of kids that make it unquantifiable to figure out what's happening, because we have a lot of kids who are now seeking private education or the public charter schools that we have. So I think these numbers are really tough to know, because we don't know how many kids have opted out of the public schools. We don't know how many kids are successfully getting their GED certificates, too. And then what I find difficult in considering all this is that charter schools are supposed to be the solution. They are supposed to be the solution for these kids. But yet, AYP standards, if you look at the data, they're not doing as well as our public schools. And yet, we have the education entrepreneurs. Charter, the Connections Academy is an out-branch of the Sylvan Learning Center. And here they make, what is it, the state school funding formula, or nearly all of it. And essentially, these kids are just getting books, and the support is pretty darn minimal. I have a hard time with that. So
I was going to say, Dr. Allman, could you kind of summarize your last points?
Okay, and I'm just about right there.
I know you're almost there.
Yeah. Well, what I just want to make sure that we all understand is that I don't think schools can do it by themselves, and we have not paid attention to the fact that that without having attention to how we partner with our families and give them the supports that they need, with safety nets and with good wages, we can't expect to do it all. But I do believe that without the appropriate funding for our public schools, as this step is trying to get to, then, you know, I mean, this is one way to get the ball moving forward.
I would say you have done an excellent job of summarizing some of our work from this session, but because a number of the points that you have made, we've discussed in depth, so I think you have a pretty good read of it.
Okay,
thank you. Mr. Lindstrom?
Hello, my name is Dan Lindstrom, originally from Bryanville, Representative Comp and chair or committee. My testimony will be more of a from the street, the sidewalk view, maybe kicked over to the curb a little bit. I think you ought to go for that $1,800 a month job. And that's what I see, especially the last man to testify on Senate Bill 384. I mean, you people are all concerned, and this lady's concerned, and I'm concerned because I read the papers, too, or I listen to the radio. And I know in Lincoln County alone, 40,000 people in the whole county, yet in, you know, we aren't even running the school at 2003 levels. Two middle schools have been closed. They've been consolidated with high schools, so we're using education money for transportation to run these kids 7 and more miles into Newport and into Lincoln City. So we're, you know, that's part of the education budget that's going for $3 fuel now. I do have hope, and that's why I want to urge you people to urge Congress to provide adequate funding. I know if we don't educate the kids, the higher education is kind of lacking because you've got to have educated kids through K through 12 to get them into, you know, community colleges or universities. And yet at the same time, I spent 4 months in Corvallis area from November to February. And there was a barometer, the campus newspaper of OSU. Ed Ray, the president, received a 15% pay raise. Well, they hadn't had a 15% pay raise for a while, or they hadn't had pay raises in 3 years. So they just knocked it 5% for the 3 years. And so that pay raise was $45,000, and he went to $340,000 a year. But Dave Frohmeyer, it said, he started out at $500,000, and he got the 15% raise, too. So evidently districts can decide who gets the money and how much. But, you know, so I guess if we have an excellent education system, it will be fine. I mean, I do see, you know, the K through 12, if we've shut down middle schools and reduced class electives and the class sizes have ballooned up and we've laid off teachers but we're using volunteers, but they can't teach because they're volunteers, so they can suggest things to students, then I don't think the level of our K through 12 is at the same level that it should be. I mean, so that's what I'm concerned about, adequate funding. You people can alert Mr. Bush that the joke is no child left with a dime. You know, that's the late night talk show host jokes. You know, I think it was Don Imus too. So I'd like them to be left with a good education. And I hope that before the next 18 months elapses, that we don't have trouble with our K through 12, because I believe somehow it's more important than a university system. Because if you can't get them to the university system with a good education, you know, that's the first steps. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Mr. Lindstrom. Excellent testimony. Any questions for this panel? We have two more people to testify. Thank you very much. Really appreciate it.
Madam Chair, we have Tom Olson and Denise Sutton.
Hi, Representative Comp. I wasn't planning on testifying today, but about 3 years ago, I didn't even vote hardly. I mean, I was so not political until something was taken away. We didn't have money in the budget for a speech and language pathologist, and that was the beginning of my battle. I filed a complaint with ODE, and back then I thought a complaint was just a complaint, but it was court. And I didn't have any representation, and I had IEPs that weren't being carried out, and the superintendent told me it was because of No Child Left Behind, and that the speech and language kids were no longer a priority in education. I went through mediation, and then I went through the IEPs being canceled on me and then reinstated, and I lost the school board deal by 10 votes. And then my consolation prize was I was able to serve on the budget committee. And when I served on the budget committee, I was able to see how the money was taken from Peter to pay Paul. And how they did that was they put it in a large cash carryover account, and I brought my budget up to see Mr. Kulongoski, and then we did away with the large carry cash over accounts, and then I sat on the budget committee when everybody was saying aye to vote for teacher pay raises, but no new books for the kids, and I'm sitting there going, what about the kids? And they already said their ayes, and I was saying nay, and that happened again to me this last week ago when I was on the budget committee. But needless to say, what really bothers me about the whole process...
Miss Sutton, I need to interrupt because I don't think I got your name for the record.
Oh, it's Denise Sutton.
Thank you.
What bothers me
Please
about
go ahead and
the
proceed.
Whole process is that we discriminate against one group for another subgroup. And I have an OCR complaint with the Office of Civil Rights claiming discrimination because... to advance these poor kids and these minorities, we do so at the expense of neglecting other children. And this is what was told to me. My son had preferential seating at the time, and all of a sudden I saw all the learning disabled kids in the back row, you know, all grouped together. And then I saw all the ELL kids right at the front row seat, and I'm like, wait a minute, what's going on here? No child left behind. And so when you're talking about punitive measures that way and not having, you know, expectations and growth for all kids, and I mean we all come in to this world different shapes and sizes, and you know, none of us all wear the same size shoe, and I mean, look at Albert Einstein. I mean, people were telling me that he was a troublemaker and everybody thought he wouldn't amount to anything. There are a lot of kids out there that have learning disabilities. I was one of them. I was also Hispanic too growing up, and that was my first language before they told my mom just to speak English to me. I am the original poster child for No Child Left Behind. Now, my whole life, I didn't know I was learning disabled. I thought I was just dumb and stupid. And I didn't quite measure up to everybody else. And I wanted to be a lawyer, you know, and I thought, well, no, you're never going to go to law school because you're just not smart enough. But I have this probing nature about myself that gets me into trouble all the time because I do question authority quite a bit. And one of the things that I really have a problem with is how I took a political science class, and I was learning from the guy that serves on our ESD board, Doug Montgomery. And I always nickname everybody, and I called him Doc because he had a doctorate degree and he was teaching at a junior college. He told me, because the last chapter was on No Child Left Behind, and did you know that for this little mandate, they only federally funded at 10%, but they want 100% accountability. Mm-hmm. And then Mr. Bush does not want to give the supplemental monies because he doesn't want to do a timeline. He wants to put billions of dollars into Iraq. And he doesn't want any accountability there, no questions asked, no timeline, no nothing. But he wants a whole bunch of accountability on our kids, and I think that's really immoral, and I think it's wrong, and I think that we need to speak up about it, and I'm glad that you're addressing it with them, because I've been screaming and squeaking all by myself out here, and I could use some backup. And so anyway, Senator Kennedy and Enzi and all those guys have been, my husband calls me the stalker, because I've written so many emails. I thought, well, you know, part of having a learning disability is you never give up. You know, you have to keep working at things a little bit more than everybody else. So
tenacity.
Yeah, a little tenacity there. But I figure if I just pester them enough, they'll submit and give us what we want here. And one of the things I'm really going after is the IDEA, Individuals with Disabilities Act, who, you know, with Darlene Hooley, when I spoke to her 3 years ago in Lincoln City, it was only funded at like 7%. And so no wonder we were shorting the special ed kids. And so we really need to get some accountability there. If they want these mandates, they need to fully fund it. And I'm really glad that somebody is failing. I was so excited. I came up from Lincoln City to make this trip up here to thank you. And I think that's great that you're going after them. And they need to be accountable, and they're not. And so anyway, that's all I needed to say.
Thank you so much.
Okay.
Appreciate your time.
All right. Thank you.
Mr. Olson.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, I appreciate the opportunity to testify today regarding Senate Joint Memorial 12. My name is Tom Olson. I live in Canby, and I'm a retired grandparent and great-grandparent. 15 of those little nippers now, great-grandchildren. My testimony today is on behalf of Oregon Stand for Children's Task Force that is currently examining No Child Left Behind. We're thrilled that this committee is also grappling with this complex law. Our nation is undergoing a very significant shift in its thinking about the very purpose of public education. Basically, there's now bipartisan agreement across the country that we owe every child in the country the commitment to help them become successful and proficient adults. But until the 1980s, our public education system and its policies focused on ensuring greater access to education. The policies required our schools to open their doors to all children and to provide equal access to good school programs. These policies did not seriously address the issue of fostering universal proficiency. But now the No Child Left Behind law, as you've heard, requires that all schools demonstrate that all children be proficient in reading and math by 2014. The law's central lever, if you will, for creating improvement is to label and punish schools and districts that do not make adequate yearly progress. The way the law is written, as Representative Comp has outlined, any school with a diverse student population has at least 150 chances to fail to meet the law's definition of adequately yearly progress. With its bewildering array of requirements and punishment, the law clearly violates the country's proud history of productive federal-state relationships, in which the federal government's role has been to supplement and support states' education systems, not to dictate them. The law's underlying assumption is that requiring more testing and imposing punitive consequences will create significant improvements in children's proficiency. That's the theory of action of this law. It's the equivalent of a cattle rancher trying to improve his herd by simply weighing them more often. At Stand for Children, we're indeed truly serious about continuous growth in proficiency for all kids and eliminating achievement gaps between the haves and the have-nots. We're committed to working with you and others in the state to bring Oregon to the top 10 states in the nation on these measures. Continuous improvement in proficiency and reducing and eliminating achievement gaps between haves and have-nots. Here are two key provisions of SJM 12 that we like. First, we agree that the appropriate role of the federal government is to give states and local districts the flexibility and resources to create this new proficiency-driven education system. We should be asking for greater flexibility to build commitment and capacity to accomplish this new purpose. In our view, SJM's suggestion for a waiver process based on demonstrated student achievement gains makes a logical and articulate case. In essence, if we in Oregon can show you that we are making significant and continued progress in students' learning, get off our backs on the specific ways that we must attain this. That's the notion of flexibility and a waiver to accomplish that. But secondly, SJM rightly addresses the fact that the dictates of the law have been seriously underfunded by the U.S. Congress. There is virtually no support given to building state and local capacity to ensure universal proficiency. I'm providing two other position statements for your review. One was just released this last weekend by the National Council of State Legislatures and the American Association of School Administrators. To my knowledge, this is the first time that those two national associations, one of national the state legislatures and the other of the school superintendents, I believe this is the first time they've signed any joint statement about anything, and they have a very powerful position statement, which I've provided. The other was recently released by the Joint Forum on Educational Accountability and was endorsed by more than 100 prestigious organizations concerned with children and public education, including Stand for Children as one of the signatories. Each of these statements reinforces the points I've made about the need for serious change in No Child Left Behind. Thank you very much. I'd be happy to respond to any questions.
Thank you so much. Any questions for Mr. Olson from the committee? Thank you, Mr. Olson. Great documents. I hate to do this, but Dr. Burke and Mr. Allen, could you maybe help? Representative Wisnett had a couple of technical questions, and Representative Dahlem also, so that we can have some clarification.
We have 2 minutes.
I'm relying on that incredible background of experience that you have, Dr. Burke.
And before we let Dr. Burke go, for the record, Morgan Allen, Legislative Director, Department of Education, I actually owe a representative an on-the-record apology, Representative Comp, because on my computer, it has Senator Avakian on our measure tracking thing, and I didn't see your name on there. So we've already visited Senator Avakian yesterday, and I would have gotten this letter to you before the committee, so my apologies about that. And I'll do that on the record.
Thank you. And as you well know, whenever I caringly want to kid somebody, I'll just say, you're fired, Mr. Orts. Representative Dahlem, you had a question that maybe Dr. Burke can help us out with.
Yeah, with No Child Left Behind, do the states write the standards?
Chair Comp, Representative Dahlem, yes, they do.
Dr. Burke, can you recognize yourself for the record?
I'm sorry, of course. I'm Pat Burke. I'm the Chief Policy Officer at the Department of Education. States are required under No Child Left Behind, and I would say also under Oregon law, to establish a set of academic content standards, a set of measurement of those specific standards, and to report out to parents and to the public student performance on those standards.
Thank you. And Dr. Burke answered my second question before I asked it. Thank you very much.
I knew he was good. Representative Wisnett.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My comments to Dr. Burke and Morgan were that I think your letter puts out some very good points about our draft resolution memorial that I think I would support the chair considering your recommendations. I think it gives our letter, our memorial, a lot more credibility.
I really apologize, Representative Wisnett. I did not hear your question.
They were short concerns.
I apologize.
I'm sorry.
Could you restate?
No, I just, Madam Chair, I was saying that I think their letter points out some things that I would be concerned about a memorial. I think I would encourage the chair to consider these and redraft this with the senator. I think it gives our memorial much more credibility to do this.
Thank you for your comments. Anything else for this panel? Thank you, Dr. Burke.
You're very welcome.
Thanks, Morgan. With that, I'm going to close the public hearing on SJM 12, and I'm going to open a work session on SJM 12. And committee, what I would like to do with your thoughts and appreciation is move this to the full without recommendation so we can work on some possible amendments, that we keep it moving in the time schedule, and that keeps me focused on my task. But I'm certainly willing to, if that's not the will of the committee, we can just leave it here for now, too.
A question for the two chairs. Would you want to start that amendment process and have it in work on the way to the full, or go to the full and start there? Because we could start the work effort now.
Go ahead.
Thank
Chair,
you,
Chair.
I think the I agree with Representative Wisnett, and I think the department's put some very specific changes to it. And I think if Representative Comp can check with Senator Avakian on those changes, we can start that amendment process just with Representative Comp speaking with Senator Avakian. We can move the bill as our chair suggests today to the full. So when the amendment is ready, we can hear the whole bill in the full with the amendment.
I think it would save us all some time.
I'm good with that. Chair Tom, I move Joint Memorial 12 to the Education Committee without recommendation.
and encourage the amendment process.
There's a motion to move SJM 12 to the full committee with some subtle hints to work on some amendments.
without
recommendations. Any discussion? Would the clerk please call the roll?
Representative Buckley?
Aye.
Excused.
Representative
Dahl?
Aye.
Representative Mintz?
Excused.
Representative Roblin?
Aye.
Representative Wisnet?
Aye.
Chair Hall? Aye. Thank you, committee. I'm going to so move.
Measure passions.
I'm a little slow after being out of the sink for a week. I'm going to close the work session on Senate.
Okay, first you have to click.
Click. Okay, that's for the passage of the motion carried.
Close the work session.
Okay, and with my able staff, I'm going to close the work session on SJN 12 and the work session on SB 384A. Anything else for the good of the order for the committee? Mr. Olson.
Just a brief reminder to committee members, subcommittee members, we'll have another meeting of the subcommittee on this Thursday and a meeting of the full committee tomorrow. Thank you, Manager.
Friday yet?
We don't plan to meet on Friday. Hopefully there won't be an afternoon floor session on Friday.
I would hope that too.
To be in district.
Very good question, Representative Wisnet. With that, I close today's hearing. Thank you, committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair.